Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, investing in local communities, economies, and a sustainable future. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Member SIPC. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Carl Weinberg is the founder of and the chief economist at High Frequency Economics. He's here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios, and it's great to see you as always. Let's start with the data this week, what you're looking for, especially, I mean, industrial production tomorrow, I imagine that's a big one you'll be paying attention to this week.
Yeah, I mean, we think the industrial production number is probably going to turn out okay based on the surveys that we're seeing. You know, the economy is chugging along. You know, we're not going to see any great numbers out of industrial production, though. You know, we're looking about maybe 0.7% for the month at high frequency. That's a little bit more than the consensus. But overall, you know, the economic growth numbers are not going to knock anybody's socks off anytime soon. We're only looking for about, you know, 2%+ growth for the year. And that's not going to be a scary number for most people.
We have the House of Representatives back in session in Washington, D.C. This week. They were off last week. The Senate was there. They were not. What's your sense of what's happening in Washington right now and the degree which that's influencing the direction of this economy in the U.S.?
Wow. Well, you know, I don't really know exactly how to go at that answer, you know, without getting into the politics of it. You know, the Comey affair has turned into a big distraction, and we had been skeptical at High Frequency Economics about the prospects for a lot of fiscal stimulus to begin with, for a really strong tax reform package to begin with, and now with all of these distractions, we're even more skeptical. So we're in the process of marking down, you know, it only takes 0.1% or 0.2 off of GDP growth, but when you're only growing at 2.5%, you can't really afford to lose a lot of it, and we think we might see a little bit of tax cuts coming up, but no major tax reform as anybody had hoped for, and very little of the big infrastructure spending that people had been looking for just a few months ago.
What's distracting the Federal Reserve right now as they push ahead to their next meeting, and they're looking at all of the data that we've gotten recently, indeed the data we'll get here before they gather again in the Eccles building. What's preoccupying them?
Well, their eyes are crossed right now, you know. They're looking at, you know, a lot of inconsistencies. They're looking at, you know, an unemployment rate that's at their level of NAIRU. They're looking at inflation numbers that aren't delivering the inflation that you would expect to see. And they're looking at an economy that should be growing, even though, you know, interest rates are down at zero right now. So they are looking at a lot of different things. I think their core belief is that at the end of the day, the laws of supply and demand haven't been repealed, that their job is to protect the country from the worst possible outcome, which given their mandate is not a recession as much as it is an overshoot of inflation. So with rising risks of inflation on the horizon, we think they're going to be responding to reducing this chance of the worst possible outcome given their mandate.
Carl Weinberg. I'm back in the New York studio. I remember where the red button is.
Yeah, self-op. Yeah.
Who's the guy to my right? Good morning, sir.
Were you gone?
Yeah. It is one of the great early successes of Boston Biotechnology. Thermo Fisher Scientific, it's 55,000 employees out of scenic Waltham, Massachusetts, and they've got themselves a new transaction. It's a $7 billion deal, $2 billion debt. It's not that big, but it's just what Thermo Fisher has done, Thermo Scientific has done, David Gura, for years. I remember I was like, who are these guys? Who are these guys? And they have just built and built and built this thing forever. Thermo Fisher takes up Patheon as well, $7 billion. David, you know, it's good to be here.
Welcome back.
It's nice to have a global cyber attack, so we got something to talk about besides the administration.
When did you come back? You came back Friday, right after the show?
British Airways did it right, actually.
Did it okay.
And what was sad was the pilots actually listened to us.
Yeah.
I met the pilots, and they
They allowed him in the Congress. They
didn't dragging off of the
plane. They did one of those YouTube landings at JFK. They came in a little bit sideways in the pouring rain. We thank them for landing the beast on the ground. Carl Weinberg knows about shear. There's wind shear within the economy. Where's the risk now for the U.S. economy? Is it a lack of investment? Is it this colossal reality? We may not get wage growth. What's the wind shear out there for this economy?
You know, I am a pilot, and I can explain that crooked landing to you.
We were doing it. We were looking at Connecticut when we landed.
In great detail. You know, the risk to the U.S. economy, I think, first of all, I'm the international guy at High Frequency Economics, yep. So I look overseas, you know, and we're looking at a world where the IMF's forecast of accelerating growth just isn't happening. And most of their hopes at the IMF annual meetings for an acceleration of world growth over the next 2 years was that the emerging world was going to pick up the pace, and they're growing their bigger share of world GDP now, so they matter, and they do. But now with commodity prices on the downswing, and I don't consider $50, $52 an oil barrel as being an upswing, I consider it to be a downswing, we're seeing their incomes being trimmed again. That's a hit to world trade, that's a hit to their ability to import, and that's a hit to our ability to export. So to me, as the international guy at High Frequency Economics, to me that's where the biggest threats are right now.
Help us understand what's going on with OPEC. We saw it tick up a little bit. Could be the broader downturn you're talking about generally, but did see oil prices move on reports that there was going to be an agreement, perhaps a longer agreement than was expected, to extend the production cuts. What's the influence that OPEC plays right now in oil prices?
Well, the influence that OPEC plays right now is that they don't have an influence, and that their ability to influence prices is increasingly decreasing with the rise of not just shale oil producers in the United States, but emerging market oil everywhere. You know, they are now a much smaller part of the world oil market than they were in the 1970s. And the adaptation or the consequence of that is that with everybody pumping the stuff up, there's more supply than demand. The OPEC ministers talk about getting inventories back down to the levels of the last 5 years. But that's the wrong bar. Oil prices have tumbled over the last 5 years hitting that bar. The real metric is that compared to the last 20 years average, OECD inventories are over their normal range for 20 years by 10 days of supply. That's half a billion barrels of oil ready to come to market. And if their deal between Russia and Saudi Arabia manages to keep, you know, a million barrels a day off of the market, we're still more than a year away from just getting inventories back down to normal. And their deal probably doesn't make even that much of a difference because everybody ramped up production beforehand.
We're going to come back with Carl Weinberg of High Frequency Economics. Right now we speak with Commander Weinberg on runway component thrust vector.
Captain Weinberg.
Captain Weinberg. And they crab.
They crab the airplane, that's right.
What does that mean?
It means that they turn the airplane into the wind so that it tracks along the runway, and then at the last minute they straighten it out so that it hits with the wheels pointing down the runway instead of toward the terminal too soon, so you go off the runway.
Do they do it manually on like a big plane like a 747?
I would say the odds of them flying it manually would be very low. It would depend on the currency of the captain, who has to do a certain number of manual landings. But for the most part, they depend on the machines. The machines are so much better
than people. And the machines do that tilting into the wind.
The technology on these aircraft, these Airbuses, and these Boeing airplanes are just absolutely incredible. Autoland is what it's called.
How many degrees do they go when they crab?
Well,
is it five degrees?
It depends on
the wind. It feels like it's 40.
Well, if you were landing in a 40-knot wind, it wouldn't be quite as much as that, but it might be substantial. But the plane's coming in at 140 knots, and if they have a 10 or a 15-knot crosswind component, they're probably not going to have to crab all that much.
Glad you're here, Tom.
This is why we love to have these guests on.
Have you two flown together?
Self-driving planes.
Self-driving planes.
Yeah, that's the future.
No, I don't think so.
So Tom could land one of these planes, is what you're saying.
No.
My wife says that in our airplane, that the way that I fly is I push buttons until it does what I want it to do. And that's more or less what these guys on the big planes are doing.
I feel like I'm with Hap Arnold or something. This is the founder of American Aviation. Do you know David Gura, Hap Arnold, his first flight was with Wright Brothers in Dayton, Ohio. That is so cool. This is your surveillance aviation moment. Carl Weinberg, that was fabulous because all of us have confronted this bad weather in one of these big airplanes. We'll come back with Dr. Weinberg and talk about international economics and the state of America. Carl, there was a jewel at the Fed 20 years ago out of MIT named one Carl Whalen. Carl Whalen was fabulous. He's now at the Irish Central Bank. And he wrote a paper, which I remember, called Real Wage Dynamics in the Phillips Curve. That's where we are right now. If we get a better economy, does inflation go up faster than real wages go up, where all of our listeners are going to feel miserable because their inflation-adjusted wages go flat or down?
You know, someone else was talking about that on Bloomberg this morning, and I nearly drove off the road when I heard it. You know,
was it John?
No, it wasn't. It was super early. I think it was one of those guys on the other side of the pond. You know, when you have inflation, inflation is a parallel increase in both prices, all prices, and wages at the same time. So real incomes stay the same. Savers are poorer, spenders are richer, and there's an incentive to spend more when there's inflation because you want to buy that refrigerator or that house today before the price goes up. And that's the traditional analysis of inflation. It's a windfall for some, but at the expense of savers.
Is it a windfall for our listeners who are out there working in the real world? They're going to get a 3% pay raise. Is inflation going to make that evaporate?
It's going to, if it's a true inflation, we're going to make it evaporate. But Tom, I'm just going to be critical here. You know, the world has gotten into this notion that CPI increases our inflation, and they're not. All right, CPI, I'm now putting on my pointy-headed economist hat here.
Well, we want that on a Monday. Right.
But every time the CPI goes up, all right, doesn't mean there's inflation. Every time there's inflation, the CPI goes up. But say the price of gasoline goes up, all right, that's a price change relative to everything else that makes people poor, actually, because their wages don't go up.
David Blanchflower would know about money illusion. Blanchflower Oswald wage curve, which was done at the time of the Wayland paper, really suggests some pain within society. Are we going to see that?
Well, if we get a true inflation, we will see that. Right? Right now, what we're all dissecting is an acceleration of the CPI. And if we don't see a parallel and proportionate acceleration of wages to match it, then workers will either be better off or worse off, but always at the expense of someone else, like either capitalists, God forbid, or savers, which is more serious. With such a big baby boomer generation now approaching retirement, you start reducing the present purchasing value of their savings, then you get into a situation where a big segment of society is worse off.
Yesterday, the new president of France put on a snappy new suit and rode around Paris in an open-air Jeep. Today, I think he meets with his German counterpart. How much does the European economy change now with his election? We had more state elections in Germany over the weekend. Does your outlook for the European economy change as a result of what we've seen in France and in Germany over these last two weekends?
Well, I think the betting has been on Macron for some time now. So I think that there's no surprise to the markets this morning right out of the box. So thinking longer term, one of the issues that Tom and I were discussing earlier today is this question of can Macron and Angela Merkel agree on what to do about England? And this, I think, is the most immediate question in front of everybody. All right, at stake, the biggest jewel out there is the city. Will they allow the city to continue to exist? Will they want that business for Paris, very high taxes, of course, or Frankfurt, much more of a friendly environment for these kinds of businesses? And the British, of course, are concerned because 15% of the UK economy comes from the city, and 2 million jobs are associated with the financial sector. Those are Mark Carney's numbers. So I think that, to me, the real question moving forward, what I want to see is what comes out of their meeting today and their subsequent communications on the Brexit question. That's the big elephant in the room.
Very quickly here, we have the snap election coming up here on June the 8th. Are we starting to see effects of Brexit playing out in the UK economy now?
Well, Tom was just over there, and I think he's probably got a bigger sense of it than I do. But certainly sitting over on this side of the pond, it looks to me like this election is a slam dunk. It just validates the national commitment to proceed with Brexit. I think there was a gray cloud put over that by some of the stuff that came out, the court challenges and all that. And I think Prime Minister May needs that unanimity behind her in order to be able to confront the Europeans. I don't think it'll help her any, but it certainly puts her in a better position than she otherwise might have been.
I don't know what was better, David Gura, Carl Weinberg on crosswind vectors at JFK or on the wage curve?
Crosswinds and gray clouds with Carl Weinberg here. Michael Cannon joins us now. He's the director of health policy studies at the Cato Institute, and I'll read from an op-ed he wrote recently for The Hill. He said, the reality is that Republicans are not repealing Obamacare. They're making it worse and offering to take the blame for its failures, which will ultimately cement that law in place. A bleak assessment of where things stand here on Capitol Hill. Michael Cannon, great to see you once again. Let's start with the state of play. This is out of the House's hands. Now it moves on to the Senate. Are you at all more optimistic that a law that you would like to see could be crafted by senators there? What do you think is the status of health care reform, of health care reform in Washington right now?
Well, I think you have to start with what's happening in the marketplace right now, which is we're seeing insurers flee the Obamacare exchanges to the point where you have some parts of the country where there are no carriers in the exchanges after December. And there are lots more parts of the country where there's only one carrier in the exchanges, so there's just one insurer exit away from having no exchange plans there. And the carriers that are remaining are asking for premium increases on the order of 50%. That comes out of Maryland, where Blue Cross Blue Shield has asked for that, on top of all the past year's increases, like 25, 27%. And so this is obviously unsustainable. And the House didn't show much of an appetite for really repealing Obamacare. They want to leave in place the regulations that are causing all this instability, causing these premium increases. And it's unsure that the Senate has any more of an appetite for that. So it may have to get worse before it gets better. We may have to see more of these premium increases, more of these market collapses, more people going without health insurance to help them pay for the medical care they need before Congress focuses on what the real problem is, which are these Obamacare regulations that are really destroying healthcare for some people.
So here's my question about those companies pulling out of these Obamacare exchanges. How much of that has to do with problems with the law and the marketplace itself versus just the uncertainty of the conversation about healthcare reform continuing? If the CEO of Aetna cites the fact that there's uncertainty in the air, it seems like that's being contributed to or driven by the fact that there's still so much legislative uncertainty surrounding Obamacare, at least in part. Do you agree with that?
Well, yeah, that's certainly a part of it. But the centerpiece of Obamacare is a series of system of government price controls that destabilizes the market. Remember when the Obama administration went to the Supreme Court, they said, well, you can't block the individual mandate because Obamacare will destroy health insurance markets if you do that. So the core of this law destabilizes insurance markets, and you need all sorts of subsidies in order to then stabilize the markets. And those subsidies were not authorized. A lot of them weren't, as of one federal judge told us.
Were you in that photo shoot at the White House? Did they invite you to that?
Well,
at the Resolute desk?
Unless you have evidence, I'm just going to deny
that. Did you think of that? They took a victory lap before the thing even got to the Senate.
It did seem bizarre. Yeah, it seemed like a mission accomplished moment because they're having this Rose Garden press conference to celebrate House passage of a bill, which is, you know, that's usually the sort of thing you hold after the bill passes. Right. You have a signing ceremony, and that's when you invite everyone to. I think that the Trump administration was desperate for a win.
Okay, I'll go with that. In your essay, you got a beautiful quote from President Clinton on the challenges of his Obamacare. I get that. Who's in support of Michael Cannon Health Economics? Who of those bodies on Capitol Hill want your vision of where we should go?
Well, there are people who have introduced the health savings account expansion idea that I put forward a number of years ago that would be a bigger tax cut than the Reagan and Bush tax cuts combined. Jeff Flake in the Senate, Dave Brat in the House have introduced
that. Jeff Flake gets the music.
And there are others. There are other members of Congress who are working on legislation right now that would repeal and replace Obamacare, and they're trying to get that into the debate.
David Gurin, Tom Keene, with Michael Cannon of Cato, truly one of the nation's experts on healthcare. Michael, CNN's got it. We thank CNN for this. And it's the usual person who really needs healthcare coverage. She has cancer in Tennessee. Quote, it's that or die, so what else would you do? Which I think is a question for a lot of us. You mentioned earlier East Tennessee is an example of where this is not working out. Where are we going to be in 1 year?
And her name is Melissa Nance, and she has an advanced form of leukemia.
How did you know that?
I know all. So Melissa is one of those people who is having their access to care threatened by the instability created by Obamacare's regulations. Now, if Melissa has a pre-existing condition, in a decent society, if she can't afford the medical care that she needs, we should do something to help her.
We used to do that, right?
But that has to be stable. Well, you know, there are a lot of people falling through the cracks of the U.S. healthcare sector, but that has to be a stable system of assistance, and Obamacare is not that.
Does Trump Care help that?
No, actually makes it worse. Uh, she, she and people like her would be in, I think, even worse shape under Trump care, because you'd have a race to the bottom even for those who have coverage.
What's the motivation, as you see it, for structuring and completing and voting upon the law that Republicans in the House voted on? Are you a cynic who thinks this is all about politics, or do you believe that there are Republicans who thought in good faith that they were doing something to change or to better the Affordable Care Act?
Well, you know, Republicans have their own sort of pre-existing condition, which is they care about taxes and don't care about health care. I like to call them the Christian Scientists of public policy. They just don't do health care. And if you look at this bill, it really shows the motivation for this bill was to cut the taxes in Obamacare, set up tax reform, and who really cares about the health care part? And people who care about the health care part are people like Melissa Nance, people like me, people who actually want a stable system of subsidies to help those with expensive illnesses.
So if I'm running a major health insurer, if this law were to pass, say the Senate were to adopt the bill as written, does that provide me with more certainty? And if so, for how long?
If you're an insurer?
Yeah.
I don't really think so, because there's still this question of because the very part of Obamacare that is destabilizing the market is still on the books. Mm. And the only way to solve that is either to repeal that, which we call community rating. It's a system of price controls. Or you can try to just subsidize the heck out of insurance companies to keep the markets from collapsing, to keep them from leaving. And so your choices are, it's really a binary choice. You can either repeal Obamacare's regulations, or you can just go whole hog on Obamacare and do what the Democrats wanted to do, is just subsidize the heck out of the market.
Where do you see all of this going? It goes to the Senate now, as I mentioned.
They rewrite it, right?
Wholly, right? Like it's going to be a whole new thing?
Yeah, there are other there are senators who've already written bills that they think would be a better approach. They're going to try to cobble together 50 senators. But I don't know what can pass the Senate. But I think that I think the longer this drags out, the probably the better the product will be, because you'll see more of the dislocation. You'll get more of the stories from people like Melissa
Nance. And there'll be more urgency.
And it'll focus their attention on the actual problem, which is the regulations.
But isn't this debate no different than when you were doing healthcare debates on that beautiful lawn at the University of Virginia? I mean, what's changed? We're arguing about, do we want to be like Britain? Many people say yes. Many people say no. I believe Cato says no. But what's the difference between this conversation and your first healthcare chat at UVA a million years ago?
I wish there were more difference. For a while there, we had Republicans we had Republicans opposed to this sort of Obamacare approach, that it would be a step in the direction of a single payer system. And now that they are sort of caving on this pledge that they made for 7 years to repeal Obamacare, they're going to bring us closer in two ways. The first way is by giving a Republican imprimatur to these ideas. And the second way is by such a drubbing at the polls that Democrats are going to take over Congress and they're going to want single
payer. But the fact of the matter is, I believe most polls show people have an affection for some elements of the Affordable Care Act. How can you catoize those constructive elements of Obamacare?
Well, they're not constructive. They're destructive. And polls say that
not the whole thing. People love it.
Yes, the whole thing. People do not love it. We've done polling on this at the Cato Institute. We've asked people, when you tie the costs to the benefit, to the supposed benefits of Obamacare, do you still like it? And Democrats oppose it.
Okay, so what, Senator? I need a common ground between Uwe Reinhardt, Michael Cannon, Senator Schumer, and I'll pick on Jeff Flake. Okay, where is the common ground to get our 17% of GDP in control so there's some sense of coherence?
I think that the only way that we're one of the necessary ingredients to getting a bill through Congress, it's a step in the right direction, is the president has to engage. He has to engage by saying that it is Obamacare's regulations that are reducing the quality of care for people in the exchanges. And that's the cost of Obamacare that actually motivates Democrats to oppose it. When you tell Democrats that these supposedly beneficial provisions actually reduced the quality of care that they and their family receive, they flip from 80% support to 55% opposition.
Was there or is there a piece of legislation that mirrors what you think should happen to the Affordable Care Act? It always surprised me. I lived in Washington for a very long time, and there was so much conversation about the repeal of Obamacare. I guess you could say the same thing of tax reform as well. There wasn't a piece of legislation ready to go. Is there or was there a piece of legislation that would in sum reflect what you think should happen to this law?
I think there is. You know, Rand Paul has a bill. Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky has a bill that would repeal Obamacare in full, provide some transition assistance for people with pre-existing conditions, and vastly expand health savings accounts, which would actually start to bring down health care prices, which is the most important form of assistance we can provide to people with pre-existing conditions and low incomes. I have some quibbles on the margins with how he goes about that. But yeah, there's that. There's legislation out there.
Yep. A lot of politicians talk about the hardness of healthcare. This is difficult stuff. Are there politicians who get it, who you admire their engagement with the issue, who are willing to hear you out and to walk through these thorny woods?
Well, like I said, Republicans have this pre-existing condition where they don't do health care. And unfortunately, there's a real, you know, sort of a wonk gap in Congress and outside of Congress where Democrats invest in this issue much more heavily than Republicans do. And they outmaneuver Republicans as a result. And so one of our jobs at the Cato Institute has been to try to bridge or make up that wonk gap. And, you know, Obamacare helped for a time, but it didn't do enough to focus their attention on this.
We're going to talk about tax reform a little bit later, but let's dovetail it quickly in the 2 minutes that we have
left.
You got
112 seconds.
A lot of people said to get to tax reform, we had to see some reform of the Affordable Care Act. Do you buy that argument? Do you think it's going to forestall movement on tax reform not having this done?
Well, what it'll do is it'll make it harder to make the tax reduction permanent because of some weird Senate budget rules. And that is really what motivated the House to pass this awful health care bill. Because it does cut taxes, and so it facilitates tax reform. And Republicans are playing to the stereotype, which is all they care about is cutting taxes, and they don't care about health care.
Tom, you didn't ask your what happens in 12 months question. What happens in 12 months?
Well, not to the Cadillac plans. We've got – what is it? Is it John Tucker, a VW plan we have, or is it a Cadillac plan? VW Beetle plan?
We had the Bentley plan.
The Bentley plan. Okay. But it's not a joke. I mean, to the people of East Tennessee and name the 18 other geographies, where are these people in 12 months?
That's hard to say. I don't think it's it's hard to say. I see two possible outcomes. One, Congress actually repeals the regulations that are causing this problem and the same legislation provides some assistance for people like Melissa Nance. Or they just try to put Band-Aids on this and we have more and more stories like that and more people falling through the cracks.
How cool was it to have Alan Meltzer at Cato? Was it great just meeting after meeting, time after time?
He's an impressive person.
Yeah. A great loss to all of economics and clearly to our policy in Washington. Michael Cannon is with the Cato Institute. Alan Meltzer was with Carnegie Mellon University. David Gura and Tom Keene worldwide, coast to coast in New York together. This is Bloomberg. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC. There's something new from Bloomberg. It's called Lens. Starting right now, you can use the Bloomberg iOS app off your iPhone or iPad or our new Google Chrome extension to read any news story on any website, scan it, and then instantly see the news story's relevant market data from Bloomberg. In addition, see all the bios of the key people mentioned in the story. It's called Lens, and it is just that, a lens into the people and the data of any story you may be reading. Again, Lens brings you the power of Bloomberg's news and data. Download our iOS app or search for the Bloomberg extension at the Chrome Store to try Lens out. Learn more at Bloomberg.com/Lens.
David Gura and Tom Keene in New York. This is Bloomberg Surveillance on Bloomberg Radio. We had the pleasure of speaking with retired Admiral James Stavridis last week while he was in Washington preparing to head up to the Dirksen Building to testify before a Senate committee on cybersecurity. He did that. And a day later, there was a huge malware attack, ransomware attack worldwide. We're still figuring out the source of that. There's still concern about its spreading. Admiral James Stavridis, now Dean of the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us. Admiral Stavridis, great to speak with you once again. Describe what we saw here on Friday, the degree to which you were worried about this beforehand and how worried we should be that we could see something like this happen again and perhaps again and again and again.
I was very worried when I testified, and I'm even more worried now. And let's face it, David, this is going to be a rolling thunder of a series of attacks. This particular one was derived from tools that were, if you will, released into the wild from the National Security Agency. They're very potent. They can be manipulated. We should expect more of this, unfortunately.
On that note, I read the blog post by the president of Microsoft, that being one Brad Smith, and he said the government should treat this attack as a wake-up call. And he said, this attack provides yet another example of why the stockpiling of vulnerabilities by governments is such a problem. Here you have some particular expertise. Why is the government stockpiling all this? What would a company like Microsoft like to see the government do?
Well, let's think of two kind of similar looming towers. One was Pearl Harbor, and another one was 9/11. In both cases, the nation took a devastating blow, and afterwards, we convened a blue ribbon commission and looked at what we need to do.
Yeah.
This time, you can see this looming tower. Let's get that group of smart people together and tell us what we need to do to protect ourselves.
James Stravitas with us with Fletcher School. Bloomberg Surveillance This Morning Worldwide brought to you by Invesco. Looking for investment views? Invesco's high conviction. Portfolio managers are just a click away. Go to Invesco.com/US to subscribe to the Invesco blog and follow at Invesco US on Twitter. Okay, Admiral, so we had Pearl Harbor. No one saw it coming except maybe Halsey, who put a third of the fleet out to sea. Where's Admiral King? Where's the Admiral King of cybersecurity to give us the urgency to get up on the table and start screaming?
I think it reposes in the business world. So it's people like Eric Schmidt. It is people like Bill Gates. It is people like Dan Schulman of PayPal. They see this looming tower, and that's why you're hearing them, as yeah. I am, talking about the danger ahead.
Well, on Windows, where's Microsoft? You know, I was doing my Walter Cronkite imitation today from Moscow to Maine. Okay, great. Microsoft. I got all the M's in there. Where is Microsoft if this is a core Windows issue?
They need to be prepared for more of this. And what is different, Tom, is the release of these tools from the National Security Agency. They are lethal devices. And I assure you, in Washington State today, those engineers are all hands on deck to try and be prepared for the next wave that's coming.
How fierce is the competition for talent here? You've unveiled a proposal here for a new service academy focused on cybersecurity. Just in terms of how many people are trained and able to do this kind of work, how fierce is the competition?
The short answer is not enough. The competition is beyond fierce. It's white hot. And we are going to have to ask our young men and women, as they do in the other branches of the military, to stand and deliver in a cyber force. Here's the good news. It doesn't have to be massive. We don't need hundreds of thousands of people, but we need 5,000 to 10,000 dedicated cyber warriors who can stand and respond to these kind of attacks, whether they come, in this case, from cyber criminals or from nation states or from terrorists.
Do you assume, Admiral, that because these people are evil, they'll always be one step ahead of our good technology intentions?
I think so in the case of cyber crime. Another way to put it, Tom, is that almost inevitably offense will overcome defense in this world. So you have to treat these cyber criminals the way we've treated pirates at sea. You need a global response to them.
Okay, folks, I failed. I tried to get through this Trump fee with the Admiral. I can't. What makes a good FBI director a wise one?
First of all, he or she has to be unbiased. Secondly, a law enforcement professional. I would argue someone who's been to law school, who's served at the highest levels of advising. And number three, the ability to speak truth to power. I think James Comey had those attributes, but he was burned by this president. Now we're going to have to ask another American to step into a very fraught situation.
James Stravitas is at Fletcher School. His book is fantastic. I'll put it out on Twitter here in a moment on leadership. It is just absolutely out. Short, you know, just typical Stravitas, David. It's just short, right to the point.
And a syllabus for you. I know you've been reading into some of the books that
I'm reading, recommend. I'm like doing the voracious reading thing. That's what I'm doing to try to keep calm, given this news flow from Kevin Cirilli. Yeah. What did you observe this weekend, David, in the Washington zeitgeist?
Yeah, you know, I'm curious to see how fast all of this plays out. The White House very eager to get somebody helming the FBI. We'll see if they're able to do that. Admiral Stavridis. We've been talking about retail over these last couple of weeks. Howard Davidovitz joined us last week. Shelley Banjo, columnist for Bloomberg Gadfly as well, painting a picture for us of the bleak retail scene here in the U.S. Joining us now is Oliver Chen. He is with Cowen and Company. Great to have him as always. So Oliver, I look at the companies you cover, the three dozen or so that you're covering. How similar is the narrative, is the story among those three dozen companies?
Yeah, what we do have in terms of a similar narrative is really the decline of physical store traffic in terms of footfall. However, it's not true everywhere. I would say department stores and mall-based retailers are seeing the brunt of this. On the other hand, I cover a wide swath of over 30 stocks. Luxury goods, in terms of the luxury spending environment, that's been great. And then deep value. So customers want to shop at outlets. They want to shop at off-pricers like TJX and Ross. And so it's not all doom and gloom, but there is a lot of doom and gloom.
We'll get to the luxury space in just a minute. Let's start with Macy's, which is where the story began during earnings season last week. I look at your note about Macy's, and you say that it's a company on a journey. How much longer are investors prepared to give this company as it travels on?
It is on this journey. It's at the epicenter of a lot of problems and disruption in the industry. I mean, investors have really penalized the stock, so the multiples come in tremendously to below 10 times, about 7 times PE multiple. The industry is around 14 to 15 when things are normal. So investors have really penalized the valuation. How long will this take? This disruption occurring with store closures is quite painful and will take multiple years. So negative comp store closures, it looks like a rough spot for a while, and Macy's is trying their best.
Part of your prescription here is for Macy's to reinvent product lead times. How difficult is that for a retailer to do?
It is challenging because it's an organizational challenge in terms of restructuring the right people in the right place at the right time. But Macy's has about a one-year lead time, and retailers such as TJ Maxx work on 1 to 2 quarters, and retailers such as Primark and H&M and Inditex can work as short as a month or a few weeks. So yeah. Macy's needs to shrink it, and that's the name of the game.
Oliver Chen with us at Cowen on retail. Oliver, one of your great strengths is the kids. You look at specialty retail and you look at what the kids want and they don't want. Is any of this discussion we're having a generational shift away from the internet, away from Amazon? When you look at the kids today, is there just a different way they consume versus before?
There is. There's profound transformations happening, and one of the key things is authenticity and really being true to yourself and you do you. So a lot of the Macy's story has been the consolidation and the sameness factor, which just isn't as appealing. You want things that really, you know, show your personal style. So Macy's needs to radically reinvent product. Also, keep in mind experiences and experiential has really transformed. So the stores need to be entertaining, and everybody wants to really display what they're doing on social media. And then casualization in terms of really the yoga pan is here to stay, Tom, in terms
of I felt the same thing this weekend. What the hell is casual? Why you? This guy's on Never Again. What is casualization?
It's kind of the opposite of your bow ties.
Fancy.
But basically, you know, athleisure is the new formal wear
CFA,
in terms of the prestige.
CFA Institute, word for that on level 3 CFA, David Gurr is slob. Continue.
We are printing new words here every day on Bloomberg Surveillance. Oliver, you mentioned luxury at the top. Let me go there into this $2.4 billion deal, Coach buying Kate Spade. Does that deal make sense to you? I walk by the Madison Avenue Coach House, see all that Coach is investing in becoming a luxury brand. This is something we've talked about with Shelley Banjo, our colleague here at Bloomberg Gadfly, about as well. Does the deal make sense to you?
Yeah, it does, because we think there's a lot of synergies. Specifically, Kate Spade can expand in China and Japan. Also, Coach has a leading leather supply chain capability. And Coach is really building America's conglomerate in terms of a modern luxury platform. We cover the European luxury retailers such as Richemont, Cartier, as well as Louis Vuitton, which we're recommending LVMH. But Coach's approach will be different. It'll be inclusive in terms of a house of modern luxury brands. We like that thesis, and we also think Kate Spade skews very attractively towards millennials. And everybody does want youth, and it's important for the long-term health and growth of a platform.
Who's the competitor there? When you look at American houses trying to get into that luxury space to compete with some of those European brands you mentioned, who stands a chance of rivaling them?
Well, we have a really limited set of luxury within the United States, so Coach kind of stands alone because they have very good handbag store product and marketing execution. The other players we have are Tiffany, Ralph Lauren, Sotheby's. Sotheby's is really on an awesome journey, becoming much more modern in their approach and broadening appeal. But Coach is really unique in terms of being aiming for multi-brand.
You've used the word journey twice. Oliver, the only thing I know about retail is when my wallet's on a journey to Gucci, it comes back lighter. Oliver Chen, thank you, Alan, this morning. Greatly appreciate it. Seriously, folks, he does just terrific work across a really wide group of retail.
Yeah.
We should frame the Congressman Kevin Brady as being north of Houston, and the Woodlands. And I love one of the articles on the Woodlands, again, north of Houston, the 8th District, up above that, is it's a safe place if you don't like snakes, because there's only three venomous ones, which is, it's a different part of the country. Kevin Brady joins us now of the Texas 8th Congressional District. He's chairman of House Ways and Means Committee. Chairman, are you distracted by all going on at the White House, or can you actually commit legislation through the end of this year?
Yes, I can. So thanks for having me this morning.
Wonderful to have you.
And the answer is, we're completely focused on tax reform. So is the president's tax team as well. And so I think one of the important things here 2 weeks ago when the president's tax team talked about his principles, what they also laid out was the timetable ahead, which is for the House, the White House, and Senate to work together to see if we can't unify behind a single tax plan. I think that is critically important if we can finish that out. And I think it better assures that we can finish this in 2017, which is our goal.
Chairman Brady, how did you react when you saw that one-pager, as it's called, from the White House? Those 200 words, those principles that you just described. When I talk to guests here at Bloomberg, executives, accountants, people from the business world, they've been operating off of your blueprint, which is more fulsome than that document we got from the White House. What do you do with that one-page piece of paper you got from the White House?
Well, actually, I was pretty encouraged because, you know, there's about 80% agreement on the key issues. We still have some work to do. Obviously, there's some differences on the rates and some on the design as well. The family portion of this, which I think keeps getting lost in the discussion, was very close. The two were very close. And so, I think we start from a very solid foundation. So I was encouraged.
You've got that 20% left then. One-fifth of this thing to sort out. I imagine part of that is this border-adjusted tax. Were you disappointed to see the White House not embrace that?
No, not necessarily. Our discussions with them have been pretty positive. Look, I think the way Secretary Mnuchin talked about it earlier that morning on that day was accurate, which he said, in effect, he said the way that that provision was originally introduced won't work, but we'll work with the House going forward to see if we can't design it and make that work. I think that's exactly accurate. Here's what we're doing. We know what our competitors do in China, Europe, Mexico, and Canada. They beat us on lower rates. They beat America by no longer taxing worldwide, and they border adjust. We made in the House a conscious decision to go straight after our competitors. And the principle is this in border adjustability, which is, look, do we want to keep the status quo, that encourages jobs to move overseas and actually favors foreign products and workers over U.S. products and workers? Or do we want to tax everyone equally in the United States so you have true competition for the first time? And it not only eliminates every tax incentive for companies to move their jobs and research overseas, it actually creates strong incentives to bring them back to the United States. We're going to make the argument and bring the case in a new design, by the way, of border adjustability to our discussions with the White House and the Senate.
Mr. Brady, you have a wonderful experience in this nation from the spine of the Midwest, from South Dakota on down to Texas. When you look at the importance of the U.S. Senate, how will they rewrite Trump Care? Do you look for them to do a complete redo that then you will have to compromise on?
You know, I don't know. That's a great question. I don't know the answer yet. What I'm encouraged by is that I think they'll take the key provisions from the House and continue to improve upon it. For example, we know that in these two big steps we're taking beyond repeal, those two big steps being let's restore the free market of insurance so people have broader choices. Let's restore state control rather than Washington control, so more innovative, so the states can design health care better to meet their needs. In that is this individual tax credit that can travel with people from job to job, state to state, home to start a business or raise a family, even into those early retirement years. We noticed is that those in the 50 to 64-year-old range, frankly, need a more muscular tax credit at that point in their life. The House sent over, almost $90 billion to the Senate. You know, we expect them to use those dollars to muscle up, power up that part of the tax credit for Americans in that age rate. That's one example.
Chairman Brady, thank you so much. David Gerd and I look forward to speaking to you
don't be a stranger.
Again.
Yeah.
Mr. Brady's from the 8th Congressional District, just north of Houston, Texas. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keene. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch, dedicated to bringing our clients insights and solutions to meet the challenges of a transforming world. That's the power of global connections. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated, member SIPC.